This is the podcast Cuba in Conversation from the Jean Monnet Network, Europe-Cuba Forum, and the Albert Hirschman Center on Democracy. The Europe-Cuba Forum is an initiative that began in 2017 and involves a consortium of 11 leading institutions with consolidated experience in researching Cuban affairs and relations between Europe and Cuba. I am Janina Welp, and today, together with experts on the topic, we will analyze the recent economic reforms and their consequences. With the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, many thought that the Cuban regime would not survive, given its high economic dependency. However, after the so-called special period, the economy recovered a bit, and later on, Venezuela took the place left by the Soviet Union as main economical supporter. It was a new period of bonanza that, after a bit more than a decade, arrived to an end and a new crisis emerged. Then, under Raúl Castro, the Cuban government sketched out a reform agenda which, while emphasizing the state's central role in the economy, included a broad range of reforms with potentially far-reaching implications. Implementation, however, has been slow and at times contradictory.
Like any couple on their wedding day, Suilén and Franklin are dreaming of a new and better life. From this moment on, my future could change. They are from a young generation of Cubans, a generation that hopes for a prosperous country.
I would like to start a business and in the future stop working and invest that money.
Talk about investment and private enterprise was until recently unthinkable in communist Cuba. But since the new president, Raúl Castro, announced the lifting of some restrictions, Suilén and Franklin will be allowed, among other things, to rent a car, spend time in a hotel, or even have a home of their own. That is, if they can afford to.
How is the Cuban economy performing? This is the focus of the second episode of Cuba in Conversation. The pandemic had an extremely negative impact on Cuba's economy. The GDP fell 11% during 2020, forcing the country to request a new moratorium on the payment of the debt with the Paris Club, with whom a renegotiation had already been carried out in 2015. In this context, the 1st of January 2021, one of the most anticipated and far-reaching economic reforms took place, the monetary ordering processes that led to monetary unification and the disappearance of the convertible Cuban peso, the CUC. The so-called ordering task, tarea ordenamiento, that involves monetary unification and, among others, price adjustments, increases in salaries and pensions, as well as expansion of activities authorized to be carried out on self-employment basis. Despite expectations, the measures do not seem to give good results. Inflation, some non-official sources talk about 500%, shortages of basic goods, and a fall in the economy growth are the most alarming indicators. But let's try to understand the reform. Listen to the explanation by Tamaris Bahamonde, a Cuban economist, master in local development from the University of Delaware in the United States.
The Cuban government introduced a set of policies as part of the monetary adjustment task or tarea ordenamiento monetario. The most important, or at least the most known policies are, for example, the retailing system in a freely exchangeable currency or moneda libremente convertible, MLC, that functions as an electronic currency equivalent to the USD. Cuban citizens could open and operate bank accounts in foreign currencies, but only through debit card issued mainly by the Cuban banking system. What started with 72 retail stores ended basically covering the a higher proportion of the retailing system in Cuba. They also terminated the CUC as a currency in the country and the multiple exchange rates. However, in reality, the Cuban economy continues working under a dual currency system due to the introduction of an extensive number of retail stores that exclusively sells in MLC, and the Cuban economy operates with a system of multiple exchange rates at this point. There was also increases in minimum wages, social security benefits, and prices. There was a reform on the state-owned enterprise. The purpose was to increase efficiency and productivity. There was an administrative decentralization aimed to improve the conditions of the economy. It was allowed by the new constitution passed in 2019. And one of the most important, or maybe one of the most mentioned policies, was the change in the ownership system. In summer 2021, the Cuban government passed legislation conferring legal personality and expanded the reach to the micro, small, and medium private Cuban enterprise. Later, regulations on foreign trade were loosened to allow the Cuban private sector to import raw materials and supplies needed for the production cycles. It was a major step forward, considering the Cubans' predominant titan foreign trade monopoly.
Professor José Alonso from the Forum Europe Cuba has stressed in his works for the Forum that any economic reform needs an institutional reform, and that part of the reasons why the reform is not working as expected is that the institutional framework has turned out to be particularly rigid and restrictive. Among the most important challenges faced by the Cuban economy today are listed: the negative consequences of devaluation on imports, a growing fiscal deficit and debt, and the increasing inequality. Is there a way out of the crisis, Tamaris?
Cuba has very limited options at this point, given the international context and the already known Cuban economy's structural deformities. However, there are three significant changes that could help the Cuban economy. First, there is a need for drastic reforms in the agriculture sector in Cuba. Over 80% of the non-profitable enterprises registered in 2021 were agriculture-related companies. It means that food production in Cuba is profoundly affected and continues to face difficulties that seem very hard to surmount at this point of high inflation and lack of access to capital. It is also essential to remove obstacles to developing domestic investments in the food industry. It includes the revision of Acopio as the mediator in agricultural market operations. Suppose we want to recover the Cuban peso's role as the national currency. Well, in that case, we must expand the retail market in the Cuban peso, which means the contraction or elimination of the parallel retail system in MLC. I know some economists might disagree, but at this point, the inequalities created and the everyday struggle of vulnerable Cubans must be a priority of the Cuban public policy. To do so, the Cuban government must review the monopoly over foreign trade. It is essential to know that maintaining this government monopoly is not sustained by any theoretical or empirical evidence that demonstrates it is more efficient or effective, and logically is not more equitable either. For example, small and medium enterprises in Cuba are bounded by a market that operates in foreign currency in which they have to compete with Cuban citizens for resources. In addition, these enterprises need for their operations imported goods that they must acquire through a complex net of state-owned enterprises. These public enterprises function as intermediaries, which logically increases the cost of imported goods, which are later transferred to the consumer, which are the Cuban people.
The ration card system, La Libreta, has been a central instrument of social policy to secure a base level of basic food to the population. There were two assumptions that are not working anymore: that state would be able to subsidize that, and that society was homogeneous. Poverties and inequalities are now growing. In this scenario, Which policies is Cuba promoting to supply foods? Could you, Elisa Botella, professor from the University of Salamanca, illustrate with agrarian policies?
Well, thanks a lot for this important question. I think it is a key problem since the special period and mainly after the 1993 food crisis that forced the island to enhance an alternative agrarian model with a more sustainable vision of agriculture based on food import substitution. In the early 90s, the main changes arose in production patterns that shift towards alternative technologies such as biological pest control and organic fertilizers. And a significant number of small producers, encouraged by researchers and academia, turned to a type of alternative agriculture based on two fundamental pillars. The first one was the substitution of imported chemicals inputs with local alternatives at much lower cost. And the second one was the return to animal production. At the same time, the state further promoted changes in the rhino structure towards cooperativism and small farming. One of the main measures taken to stimulate domestic food production was the conversion in 1993 of state farms into new agricultural production cooperatives called Basic Units of Cooperative Production, UBPCs. The new cooperatives gave the land in usufruct to the cooperative and imitated the type of production developed by collective small farms. Together with a series of additional measures to liberalize internal food market and the free delivery of usufruct lands to small producers, new cooperatives, in a sense, open spaces for peasants and increase their capacity to produce food for national consumption. The essential change in Cuba's agrarian structure was not only the creation of UBPCs, but also the gradual expansion of land, mainly usufruct, into the hands of individual smallholders.
Elisa, you have explained somewhere that contrary to the concept of food safety, the idea of food sovereignty is a political one coming from below. Could you explain us the idea and locate Cuba's position in this debate and development?
In the early 21st century, we see this significant global progress towards recognizing the need for agricultural alternatives to neoliberal globalization. Farmers, groups, and NGOs, particularly in Latin America and Asia, demanded greater space to discuss the implementation of this strategy. The idea of food sovereignty clearly emerged over the past two decades within these alternative frameworks, while the precise origins of the concept appear to be in the Central American and Mexican peasant movements. The contemporary political discourse of food sovereignty was first brought to the public debate at the 1996 World Food Summit of the Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome by the NGO Via Campesina. This transnational peasant movement, aligned with national farmer and peasant organizations in countries around the world, claims the return to more control over food systems to small-scale farmers and to other subsistence and small-scale food producers. Food sovereignty promotes diversified and community-based food production schemes, the right of peoples to decide their own food and agriculture, and the protection and management of local agricultural production and trade in order to achieve sustainable rural development. As stressed by different scholars, a food sovereignty definition has evolved over time, with the most recent description agreed upon by La Via Campesina in 2007 as the right of peoples to healthy and culturally prepared food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and the right to define their own food and agriculture systems. This definition emphasizes direct, even local control over food production and consumption, and it puts those who produce distribute and consume food at the heart of food systems and policies rather than the demands of markets and corporates. To locate Cuba's position on food sovereignty, it is important to recognize that since the arrival of Raúl Castro to power in Cuba, food sovereignty entered more clearly into the political agenda. Beginning in 2007-2008, the Cuban government implemented a series of structural transformations aimed at increasing the country's food self-sufficiency and reducing the island's historical import dependence. These transformations included the transfer of state lands to private producers, industrial food price reforms, more decentralization in decision-making, and a move gradually to more flexible commercialization structure. As a result, and according to the last land use panorama or panorama de uso de la tierra in Cuba, individual small farmers account for 40.1% of the total cultivated area, surpassing the rest of agricultural structures in Cuba. Okay, in sum, the administration of Raúl Castro gave priority to peasant agriculture and food import substitution, two variables that are closely related. These imports seems to remain with Miguel Díaz-Canel through the Decree Law 358, economic and social strategy to strengthen the economy and to confront the crisis generated by the pandemic that has given priority to food production and food sovereignty, as shown by the recent Food Sovereignty Program release in 2020.
In your work, you analyze the path followed by Cuban migration and the evolution of remittances strongly affected by the pandemic. Could you please draw a picture of the numbers of Cubans living abroad and their connections with the island, particularly their economic connections? Which kind of specific challenges this relation poses, from travel restrictions to cryptocurrencies, for instance?
According to the International Organization for Migration, Cuban migrants account for between 10 to 15% of the total Cuban population, which is 11 million Cubans. The United States is the main country of destination, which hosts around 2.4 million Hispanics of Cuban origin, and particularly 1.3 million Cuban-born subjects. In Miami-Dade County alone, more than 600,000 Cuban-born migrants live. In Spain, there are around 62,000 Cuban-born immigrants, with a major presence in Madrid, among other cities. Cuban migrants maintain their economic connections with those in the island. In this respect, they send remittances, which is a portion of the migrants' earnings, to support their family consumption in Cuba. The frequency and size of remittances varies, depending on multiple factors such as having a job, their personal and household incomes, having savings, as well as how many people they want to support on the island. For instance, their capacity to send remittances might be affected if they are unemployed, if they don't have savings, or if their incomes are low. Sometimes they send larger amounts in the face of unforeseen needs, such as, for example, the pandemic, or a natural disaster when their family needs emergency funds. On the island, Cuban families cover essential needs with remittances. In fact, a survey suggested that around 94% of remittances support family consumption, especially food purchases. And it is also interesting to see that in communities abroad, like in Miami, Cubans go to ethnic stores where they buy cheap merchandise to bring to Cuba, like, que barato store. And in addition to the survival strategies, remittances also support development strategies, such as family restaurants, room for rent, private transportation, photography, and design businesses. One of the challenges affecting the relationship between Cuban immigrants and those on the island have been the impact of policies, particularly remittances and travel policies. There have been moments in which the U.S. administration prohibits or imposes caps on remittances while others when they have eased the restrictions. For instance, the former Barack Obama administration eased restrictions on remittances and travel to Cuba. Any U.S. person was allowed to send remittances to individuals on the island, an amount of $2,000 per quarter. Likewise, travelers were permitted to carry up to $10,000 to Cuba. Nonetheless, former Donald Trump administration rolled back these policies, introducing restrictions on travel and remittances in 2019. Additionally, a critical impact had those policies in 2020 when the Donald Trump administration ordered the closure of Western Union. This Western Union was the leading U.S. remittance agencies operating on the island for decades. Notably, these policies took effect in the context of the pandemic, which had various effects. I could mention three. First, these restrictive policies belittled Cuban immigrants' concerns about their families during trying times, limiting their ability to provide support. Second, they also limited the Cuban migrants' capacity to support private businesses. Third, while Cubans living in the United States found ways to send remittances, they did it through a third country mostly. Therefore, transaction costs were higher, affecting primarily those who were low-income immigrants or recent immigrants. As mentioned before, Cuban migrants found alternative ways to send remittances. One of them was exploring cryptocurrencies. Digital platforms opened a new world for Cuban migrants who are enthusiastic to explore opportunities to send remittances from the comfort of their mobile phones, tablets, and computers.
We are arriving to the end of the second episode of Cuba in Conversation devoted to the economy and economical reform in Cuba. As we see, the situation in the island is quite complicated for the population and many reforms are needed despite the reforms that have been decided and are in process of implementation. The Forum Europe Cuba elaborated some recommendations that we can list now and summarize. Some of these recommendations include the modernization and opening of the economy, introducing more efficiency and productivity. It is also suggested that to give the continuity to the economical reforms is required to have a strategic plan with feasible goals, something quite relevant for the current discussion today. Institutional changes are required to give support to the economical reform. Then, to take advantage of comparative advantages in sectors such as tourism or food production, the production must be linked to global value chains with an increase in regulated private activity that allows the development of small and medium-sized enterprises. Then also to reduce the deficit in infrastructure and access to communication is key to the development of the private sector, but also is required the modernization of the sector, which still has hundreds of public companies with structural losses. Another essential element stressed by the reports and the policy brief in the Forum Europe Cuba for this blog is to support the advances in the process of territorial decentralization and the empowerment of local governments, as well as to reduce the bureaucratic state apparatus. The new international cooperation instruments that the European Union has developed open a window of opportunity for cooperation with Cuba to develop a more strategic vision and offer opportunities to Cuban citizens who today face an uncertain situation. My thanks to Tamaris Bahamonde, Elisa Botella, and Denise Delgado Vázquez. For more information about the project, you can visit the website foreuropacuba.org. I am Janina Welp, Research Fellow at the Albert Hitchman Center in Democracy, and along with other experts from the Jean Monnet Network Europe-Cuba Forum, we explore institutional, economic, and global recent developments in Cuba and potential future path for the country. Join us in a brand new on any podcatcher of your choice by searching Cuba in Conversation. And subscribe so you can get the latest updates on our episodes and our research.